Welcome to another episode of the Criminal Law Department Presents podcast, a production of the Criminal Law Department at the Judge Advocate General's Legal Center and School in Charlottesville, Virginia. Every 2 weeks, we release a new episode. Today, we're going to have a conversation about a recent opinion from the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces. Please note that these episodes may contain facts and circumstances surrounding criminal trials. Listener discretion is advised.
All rise. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable United States Court of Appeals of the Armed Forces is now open and in session. God save the United States of America in this honorable court.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Criminal Law Department Presents CAF Chats. Because we're so often mistaken, I have to inform you that I am, in fact, not Major Rand Wentz, United States Army. But with me is...
not Lieutenant Colonel Dave Seagraves, United States Marine Corps.
Today, we're going to be talking about the United States versus Major Anthony R. Ramirez, United States Army. The case was argued on October 24th, 2023, and the CAF decided the case on February 29th, 2024. This case is all about voir dire. More specifically, in what cases does a military judge have to include questions regarding ethnic or racial bias during voir dire? Major Wentz, what is the procedural history facts of this case?
Major Anthony Ramirez invited himself over to watch the Super Bowl with one of his junior officers. After the junior officer fell asleep, Major Ramirez made multiple advances toward the junior officer's wife, which she rejected. She further recorded Major Ramirez making these advances and her very clearly rejecting them. Eventually, Major Ramirez took the hint and went into the guest room. The junior officer's wife woke up her husband and told him what happened. He then proceeded to punch Major Ramirez and told him to leave. Major Ramirez was eventually charged with attempted sexual assault, abusive sexual contact, and assault consummated by a battery, and conduct unbecoming an officer. At trial, Major Ramirez's defense counsel submitted a proposed voir dire question, which read, quote, "Does anyone's cultural background influence your perception on relationships between individuals of different races?" The military judge did not allow the defense to ask this question, but only indicated this ruling by checking a box on a form indicating that it was, quote, "too confusing, a trick question, or unhelpful to ferreting out sincerity and ability to sit as a panel member." The military judge provided no further analysis or basis for the denial. The defense did not submit any additional questions or attempt to reword the question that had been denied.
Additionally, the military judge provided both sides a chance to submit requests for reconsideration of his voir dire rulings by the night before trial. Defense didn't submit any requests. On the first day of trial, the military judge again offered to entertain any motions for reconsiderations on his voir dire rulings. Again, defense counsel did not make any requests for reconsiderations or objections to the military judge's denial of the race-related question. Finally, a matter that we'll get into during our discussion, neither the appellant's race nor the race of the junior officer or his wife was explicitly put on the record during the trial. Okay, now specifically, what issue did the CAF grant?
The issue that CAF granted is a little bit different than what CAF eventually decided, but the issue they actually granted on was whether the military judge abused his discretion in not allowing the defense to inquire into racial bias during voir dire.
Now, Major Wentz, how did the CAF analyze this case?
Bottom line, sir, CAF held that the military judge did not abuse his discretion, but also, quote, noted, and that's the court's language, not mine, that the issue was arguably forfeited through defense counsel's failure to clarify his question or request reconsideration of the military judge's ruling. Frankly, in my opinion, sir, this case is a little bit more about forfeiture than it is about voir dire into racial bias, but the court manages to discuss both.
Okay, so it seems the defense counsel dropped the ball because they didn't follow up or make any objections. We can talk about that more later when we talk about how this might affect the field. But let's talk about the court's general discussion of voir dire into racial bias. The court first noted the rules for court-martial and case law generally provide a great deal of discretion to military judges to determine the nature and scope of examination to panel members. But then they got into applying the law to specific facts of this case. What was their ultimate holding, Rand?
Yes, sir. Like I said before, CAF held that the military judge did not abuse his discretion in denying the voir dire question. Now, the court hung most of its sort of collective hat on the fact that the defense counsel forfeited the issue. The defense did not ask about the military judge's rationale and didn't submit any additional questions. Further, the CAF also heavily relied on the fact that defense and the appellant failed to discuss race during the trial. And that's a quote from the opinion. The court then continued, and the fact that appellant was acquitted of the most serious charges against him, it is hard to give credence to his assertion that racial bias may have denied him a fair trial. So ultimately, Sarah Caff said that there was no obligation for the court to allow this question.
The CAF went beyond defense forfeiting the issue. They also responded to defense's contention that the military judge had a duty to ask about racial prejudice simply because the appellant requested it in this case. The CAF did not agree. Specifically, they set out the circumstances that would require a military judge to inquire about racial or ethnic biases of the panel. Rianne, could you lay out those for the listener?
Yes, sir. So both the majority opinion and Chief Judge Olson's concurring opinion rely on the Supreme Court's ruling in Rosales Lopez versus United States to lay out when a military judge has to permit inquiry into potential racial or ethnic bias of members. And the CAF adopted the language of Rosales Lopez in the first instance, requiring inquiry into potential racial bias of members, and used this language. Federal courts must permit voir dire inquiries into the potential racial bias of prospective jurors when requested by a defendant accused of a violent crime and the defendant and the victim are members of a different racial or ethnic group. So there are a couple of wickets that have to be hit in order to sort of require that inquiry, sir.
So under that standard, if a defense counsel's client was charged with a violent crime, such as sexual assault, defense would just need to put on the respective races or ethnicities of their client and the victim on the record, and then ask for the voir dire questions or question about these possible biases of the members. What's the other scenario when a military judge has to permit questions into the members' possible racial or ethnic biases?
So the other scenario is that there are constitutional requirements with respect to questioning prospective jurors about racial or ethnic bias if racial issues are inextricably bound up with the conduct of the trial. Now, under this scenario, trial judges are required to specifically inquire into possible racial prejudice in order to assure an impartial jury. Now, sir, I'll be interested to see sort of how this is interpreted. I know that there's probably some federal case law out there, but I'll be interested to see how military courts interpret it. I think there's an argument borne out by social science research that in nearly every case where there is a person of color accused and a white victim, race has, you know, the potential to be at issue. You know, is it CAF's intent that it only be specifically race-related? So, for example, you know, a case charging disrespect to a superior commissioned officer that was motivated by racial animus? You know, I don't know. I will be interested to see how narrowly or broadly trial judges sort of interpret, you know, this inextricably linked language. To illustrate what they think is a bright line, CAF contrasts a case called Risitano and a case titled Ham versus South Carolina. In Risitano, it was a violent crime between a black accused and a white victim, but that wasn't enough to trigger sort of the constitutional dimension and require that inquiry into racial or ethnic bias. However, in Ham, the defense's theory was that law enforcement officers had framed him because of his civil rights activism, and that sort of had clearly triggered that constitutional requirement for that inquiry. We'll get to this later, but I'm just not sure that it's as clearly defined maybe as CAF has posited. On a related note, sir, we talked earlier about how CAF mentioned that the defense never mentioned race during the trial. And, you know, quite frankly, sir, I'm not sure how the defense would have brought up race during the trial other than in, you know, voir dire, which is when they tried to do it. You are, in fact, the resident evidence expert. Do you have any thoughts on how they might have done this per CAF's sort of pseudo requirement?
Turning the tables on me. I like it, Rianne. So both of my main theories of how race could have come into play would come in the form of impeaching the government witnesses under MRE 608 Charlie. MRE, or Military Rule of Evidence, pardon me, 608 Charlie, says bias, prejudice, or any motive to misrepresent can be shown to impeach a witness, either through cross-examination or through extrinsic evidence. Now, we haven't reviewed the records, but hypothetically, if defense counsel had uncovered some racial bias or prejudice on the part of law enforcement, they then could have impeached the law enforcement's investigative efforts. In a different hypothetical, if the defense counsel uncovered some racial bias or prejudice on the part of either the junior officer or his spouse, the defense counsel could have presented a consent defense, saying the junior officer's spouse was interested in the appellant's advances and only made the allegation because she was concerned her husband would find out, or something like that. Again, these are not the facts before us in this opinion. These are only examples of how the issue of racial bias or prejudice could have come up in a case similar to this one. Now, Rianne, I think we had a good discussion of how the CAF analyzed the issues that and made the rulings. Now, let's turn to how this case maybe might affect the field. You know, other significant cases, rules, you know, how they might be implicated.
Yes, sir. Well, first and foremost, defense counsel have to preserve the issue. And I know that it can be uncomfortable, but defense counsel really have to kind of dig in with the judge when you need to. Ask follow-up questions, ask the judge to clarify their ruling, or if the judge says this question is too confusing or that it won't be helpful, rephrase the question and submit it again. That's how you preserve the issue. And it would have been harder for CAF to say that the issue had been forfeited. Secondly, defense counsel need to know the rules. If you have a client who is charged with a violent crime and whose alleged victim is of a different race or ethnicity, the defense counsel need to know that they will get to inquire into racial or ethnic bias if they show the court that these requirements are met. Now, I will say that, you know, inquiring to this is a really fine art and can be really difficult, but it's something defense counsel need to be aware of and sort of be prepared to handle. Finally, it's worth looking at two points that Chief Judge Olson mentions in his concurring opinion. So not only did he point out that there are constitutional requirements with respect to questioning prospective jurors about racial or ethnic bias if racial issues are inextricably bound up with the conduct of the trial, he also said that military judges need to note that if the defendant is not accused of a violent crime, but the, quote, defendant claims a meaningful ethnic difference between himself and the victim, his voir dire request should ordinarily be satisfied. Only when there is a reasonable possibility that racial or ethnic prejudice might have influenced the jury does a military judge's failure to honor the defendant's request constitute reversible error.
Now, those sites alone suggest, you know, they suggest that the military judge should ordinarily grant defense's request. But the quoted Supreme Court case says it's reversible error only when there is a reasonable possibility that racial or ethnic prejudice might have influenced the jury. So prospectively, when preparing for motions or bench briefs to support their voir dire questions into racial or ethnic biases in nonviolent crime cases, what should practitioners be considering?
Sir, I think all justice practitioners should be thinking about the implicit and explicit bias of their fact finders. Does race play more of a role in certain cases than others? Absolutely. However, I would argue that based on research, that it is always worth consideration, especially when there is an accused who is a service member of color and a white victim. Like I said before, conducting voir dire that gets into potential bias is very, very difficult. And I would posit maybe even more difficult with service members who know that they are required by regulation to be fair and impartial, but who we also know as human beings, you know, may not be. So to start with, there are a variety of studies that show that racial bias of jurors has the potential to affect the civilian criminal legal system. And although we have different panel members in that all of our panel members are service members, they're not sort of just sort of Joe Schmo off the street. They are, again, human beings that we know are affected by bias. As an example, right, there are several studies that have shown that defendants convicted of murdering a white victim are more likely to receive the death penalty than defendants who are convicted of murdering a black victim. Further, black defendants were more likely to be sentenced to death. In 2006, Jennifer Eberhardt, Paul Davies, Valerie Purdy Vaughns, and Sherry Lynn Johnson published a paper which found that in cases involving a white victim, the more stereotypically black a defendant is perceived to be, the more likely that person is to be sentenced to death. In 2017, Hannah Phelan, Jessica Salerno, Madison Adamoli, and Janice Nadler published a paper which found that jurors' emotional reactions to victim photographs were felt selectively depending on the victim's race and could exacerbate racial biases in jurors' judgments. So these are just a couple of examples. You know, a cursory search of an academic database will pull several more. And we also see, of course, that explicit racial bias comes up in cases. There's the case of Andre Thomas, you know, a black man who was convicted of murdering his white wife and mixed race child. After he stabbed them, he actually gouged out both of his eyes at different times and actually ate one of them. He was schizophrenic. In his case, three jurors on their questionnaires wrote things like having interracial relationships is against God's will and that people should, quote, stay within their bloodline. The defense attorney for Mr. Thomas didn't further question two of these jurors, and all three of them that wrote things like that, sat on the jury that sentenced Mr. Thomas to death. Mr. Thomas petitioned the Supreme Court for certiorari with a claim of IAC because his lawyers sort of failed to inquire into these jurors. Cert was denied, but Justice Sotomayor drafted a dissent to the denial of cert in which she states, quote, historians have long recognized that interracial marriage, sex, and procreation evoke some of the most invidious forms of prejudice and violence. And actually, another example of a case is a case that appellant cites in his brief to CAF, which is the case of Peña Rodriguez versus Colorado. It's a Supreme Court case which involved a Hispanic man charged with sexually assaulting two teenage girls. No specific inquiry was done into racial bias of the jurors, and later a juror was overheard saying things like, quote, Mexican men are controlling of women, and quote, 9 times out of 10, Mexican men were guilty of being aggressive toward women and young girls. Now, the Peña Rodriguez case was not about voir dire, but about Colorado's no impeachment rule. But it's just another example of the fact that folks with both implicit and explicit bias can sit on juries. So it's something for the defense counsel and anybody involved in the justice process to be cognizant of and to be thinking about and make sure that it is at least a consideration when you're doing your case preparation.
Thanks, Rianne. That's a lot of great information. Should be very helpful to the practitioners in the field. As we bring this episode to a close, we'll just sum up the ways practitioners should be able to get these types of voir dire questions. First, for all of them, remember, defense must ask for these questions. So first, the accused is charged with a violent crime, and the accused and the victim are of different races or ethnicities. Those types of questions are required if defense asks for them. Next, if racial issues are inextricably bound up with the conduct of the trial, and we gave you the examples of impeaching government witnesses on the racial or ethnic biases and how they affected their actions, or possibly showing some sort of bias on any member of the government's witness list. And finally, showing the court that there is a reasonable possibility that racial or ethnic prejudice might influence the jury, which Rianne just provided some great arguments for practitioners to consider with the potential implicit and explicit bias of members. Rianne, did we miss anything?
No, sir.
Thank you very much, Rianne. I'm glad I had a chance to record a podcast episode with you, and it's been great having you on the faculty with the Criminal Law Department.
Thank you, sir.
And thank you, listeners, for tuning in to this episode of Criminal Law Department Presents CAF Chats. We appreciate you sharing this time with us, and as Major Josh Mickelson would always say, don't forget to smash that subscribe button.
Thanks for joining us today for another episode of the Criminal Law Department Presents podcast. If anything you heard sparked a thought, we'd love to connect with you. Your comments help us create better future content for the field or the fleet. Reach out to us on Facebook or Instagram. The information can be found in the show notes for today's episode. The views expressed in today's podcast are those of the presenters and not necessarily the Judge Advocate General or the Department of the Army or the Department of Defense.
Thanks, counsel, for both sides. And the court will stand in recess until further order of the court.